Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout.com, a gathering place for people who love movies. Sign up for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Matty Robinson. This week we prove once again that actors really can do anything with our top five debuts by actors turned directors.
This is going to be a long show, isn't it? Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music from Utah Carol, and a review of the new political, some might say polemical, thriller, Rendition.
But first, Ben Affleck directs Casey Affleck in Gone Baby Gone.
Elaine puts her to bed. She goes across to Dottie's, then she comes home, and Amanda is gone.
Who would take my little girl? She never hurt anybody.
A four-year-old child is on the street. If we don't catch the abductor by day one, only about 10% are ever solved. This is day three.
Do you know people in the neighborhood who don't talk to the police?
One or two.
We want to hire you to augment the investigation.
Mr. Kempinar, it's been quite a year for the brothers Affleck. Ben is coming off of plum reviews of his portrayal of George Reeves in 2006's Hollywoodland. And of course, more importantly, my Us Weekly tells me he's happily married to Jen Garner and a new father. Casey Affleck is coming off of what has to be considered a breakout role in the assassination of Jesse James. Now we get an Affleck collaboration on an adaptation of a Dennis Lehane novel, he of Mystic River fame, with Gone Baby Gone, in which Casey stars as a third-rate detective in the southy neighborhoods of Boston, hired by a concerned sister-in-law to track down her kidnapped niece, and brother Ben directs. Now, Ben Affleck obviously is afforded the opportunity to direct here because, well, he's Ben Affleck. Hell, he can produce it, as he did here. And I'm sure there are hundreds of recent film school grads gnashing their teeth, wishing, hoping they could get a chance to direct this material. So my question to you, Adam, is this. Does Affleck come through, or would you have liked to have seen this material in slightly less celebrated hands?
I think Affleck comes through. For the most part, I do. There are things about the film that definitely didn't work for me, some that I think can probably be blamed on Dennis Lehane's source material, though I have not read it in terms of the plot, and I think we'll talk about that a little bit. But there are other things that didn't work that are definitely attributable to Affleck's direction. Where I give Affleck a lot of credit, though, is in having the conviction to make a really depressing, heartbreaking movie, one that doesn't offer up any easy answers or back away from presenting a lot of really damaged characters. And there's a line early on in the film where Michelle Monaghan, as Casey Affleck's girlfriend and assistant, tells him, look, we have a good life, right? Don't take this case. And it's obviously foreshadowing the effect this case is going to have on their lives that you would expect it to have on anyone delving into the really dark side of humanity, as this film does. But the film actually ends up much worse than I imagined it. And a lot of these characters end up much worse than I imagined they would, being really damaged in a way that you know they'll never recover from. And I think that Affleck handles that deterioration in a really subtle, non-melodramatic way. I haven't really been able to shake this movie since I saw it, especially the final shot, much like I remember being kind of traumatized by the ending of Mystic River, the book, and later the film. So I actually do give Affleck a lot of credit for producing and co-writing and directing a film that did leave me that shaken by the end of it.
Yeah, I can give it a mild recommendation as well. Mm-hmm. I think really some promising stuff, but a little bit too uneven to get behind wholeheartedly. But if this were, say, in my Netflix queue and it came on a cold February night, I certainly would like to revisit it. Mm-hmm. It is good enough, and you're right. The ending is really a success for me because I was starting to drift away from this movie a little bit, but it puts you there at the end, and it really makes you ask, what would you do in that situation? Mm-hmm. And I did find myself saying, my God, this is gut-wrenching.
You don't know.
Exactly. Yeah. But getting to your point about the deterioration of characters, I think he gets some of them right and some of them just mishit a little bit. What he gets right are the authentic Southie Boston characters. I can't say enough about Amy Ryan as the mother here. Mm-hmm. She is just absolutely transcendent as this heroin junkie mother whose daughter gets kidnapped. Go check out her picture on IMDb and look at the transformation that she's undergone. And also her friend, Jill Quigg, who plays Dottie. She only appears in two scenes, but she has this one monologue where she's addressing the news camera and she asks everybody, you know, the neighborhood's really coming together. We're going to have a vigil. It was just dead on. Yeah. And so you can tell that Affleck obviously knows these characters. He knows this location. He knows the situation. What didn't work for me, however, was the Ed Harris and the John Ashton and the Morgan Freeman characters, basically mm-hmm. the cops. They seem to be from a different movie. And unfortunately, Ed Harris's character has to go through the most changes, the most reversals, and he's not given enough screen time to do it. We get a lot of backstory on Casey Affleck. We get to see him, you know, really affected by the process of this case. But Ed Harris sort of resorts to screaming about three quarters of the way into this film, and I think it's indicative of his frustration with the lack of material he was given here.
Maybe, but I think he's so effective in those scenes, even when he's yelling.
No,
yes, for me, Ed Harris is almost always gold, and I think he's gold here. I really did see the anger and frustration of his character, not Ed Harris, the actor. I thought he was really good here, though. I do agree with you. One of my problems with the film does involve the way some things shake out with some of those characters mm-hmm. in power, and obviously this isn't a spoiler edition. We can't get into it really specifically here, but what I am bothered by is that the plot does become, if not convoluted, at least contrived.
Yeah.
There are huge moments in the story, huge emotional moments that revolve around coincidences, just as they did in Mystic River. And when you sit back and really think about how everything plays out by the end of it, you really start putting all the pieces together.
Yeah.
You're left thinking, okay, all these people set in motion this horrible chain of events for that reason. It really is pretty far-fetched. And I understand what Lehane is going for, and I can see how Lehane and Affleck and his co-writer here saw the emotional impact and mm-hmm. the moral and ethical dilemmas that these characters are dealing with, but it doesn't really add up in terms of being believable what these characters are trying to do.
I'm willing to forgive it for being far-fetched. I think that's okay, but I think the way that it's handled, I mean, there's almost two different narratives that happen here in this film, and in the middle, they're just sort of tied together, tethered together by a little string. And I think what you're referring to is the Morgan Freeman character and what he goes through mm-hmm. and how he comes back at the end of the film. We leave him. You know, he leaves about halfway through the film, and he just kind of disappears, and so does that plot line. And that's the thing. Is this Casey Affleck's film? Is this his journey? And these tertiary characters, the Ed Harris's, the John Ashton,
mm-hmm.
you know, these people that have ulterior motives other than just finding this girl, their stories are not made as clear. He doesn't set them up as well because we spend so much time with Affleck.
Right, and I understand that because obviously I do see his character as the main character
yeah.
and the person we're following on this journey. But then the end result is, and this is where I get back to that idea of it being contrived, is that then when these characters end up taking on greater significance in the story,
mm-hmm.
it feels a little bit like a trick. It feels like a gotcha.
Exactly.
It all of a sudden comes
in at the
end. I think
we're actually agreeing here.
Yeah, we are definitely yeah. agreeing, I think, here. So, and again, I blame that on Lehane a little bit. Again, I haven't read the books, but I think it probably had to be in the book the way the story shakes out. And again, these are some problems I had as well with Mystic River in terms
mm-hmm.
of a lot of big, emotional, heavy stuff happens, and you really do buy into it. And then you sit back and look at it and go, wait a second, so we're asked to buy that this happened at the same time this was happening, and so on. Some things just don't quite play out. But I also give Affleck a lot of credit for some of the writing here. And there is a showdown scene, I think, with Affleck and this drug lord character that is reminiscent of the bar scene in Good Will Hunting, where he gets to tell off the more powerful character. And that is really effective, I think. But I was just really impressed with the way the movie deals with how divided Boston is, not only along these neighborhood and ethnic lines, but the class lines as well. And you mentioned Dottie. My favorite Dottie moment is when Angie, Michelle Monaghan, and Patrick, Casey Affleck, walk into the house for the first time to meet the mother. And Dottie's sitting there on the couch next to the mother. And she looks up and she says, hey, I went to school with you, right?
Yeah.
To Michelle Monaghan. And she goes, yeah, we were in school together, whatever. And she goes, I noticed you're still conceited. You still look a little conceited, right? It's this idea that she walks in, and it's probably just the way her hair is.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something about the way she looks, maybe even the way she's just looking around the room, that immediately sends this signal off in Dottie that says, she thinks she's better than me. And you see that play out throughout the film, especially in the relationship, too, between Affleck and Ed Harris, where we get this great moment where they discuss how Ed Harris is originally from New Orleans. And
mm-hmm.
you can tell that Casey Affleck thinks, you know, that maybe he's a little bit better than him because he's more authentically Boston. That whole idea of what defines you and defines you in this space, in this neighborhood, in Dorchester, is really fascinating. It's a thread I think Affleck explores really well throughout the whole movie.
Well, I think you're right. I think you're getting back to my original point. He gets the authentic parts of this story absolutely right. It's only when those other characters who
mm-hmm.
aren't from there come in conflict with those characters. And, you know, he also has a little bit of a technical problem here dealing with people when there's four or five people in a room arguing or talking. There's just some angles that are a little bit off. Just some things that are a little bit off that I think he can tighten up a little bit. But all in all, I'm going to say, yeah, it's a promising start for Mr. Affleck.
Yeah, I agree completely. I do agree with you on some of the angles, some of the ways he uses sound where someone's talking off screen and it almost feels unnecessary or like it was maybe a mistake. It just doesn't quite work. There is an awkwardness to some of those scenes. I do think as well that he may go a little too far in trying to be authentic. Instead of showing this insider's perspective on what Boston is really like, I think he comes off as an outsider. His camera, to me, seems a little bit drawn to only the most grotesque images, and it never feels natural to me, especially early on in the film where he's setting up the neighborhood and we see the people in this neighborhood. It's as if he's leering a bit at these characters.
Now, see,
and
I like that. I like that.
It seems to me, again, like maybe he's one of those people. He could come off as one of those people who maybe thinks he's better than these people because he seems so intent on showing the things that are really disturbing. And there are moments, too, not just in those kind of montages, but in some of those scenes with multiple characters where he can't help but show us, for example, the mom go to the fridge in the middle of the day and he has to cut to the close-up of her grabbing the six-pack from the fridge, or them in the kitchen and he has to cut to the sink to show us the dishes and the filth in the sink. Yeah. There are a lot of moments like that.
That's a good point. I wish he just let
those characters inhabit that space, and I would have seen that for myself. I didn't need his camera to show me all those things.
Yeah, exactly. Well, a lot of his actors do the heavy lifting for him, and I think, you know, that shows he knows what it's like to be on the other side of the camera. He should have trusted them just a little bit more.
Well said. So it does sound like we are on the same page with this film. Certainly a flawed movie, but effective in many other aspects. And Gone Baby Gone is in theaters now. If you've seen it and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463. And leave a voicemail.
All right, time for a quick break. When we come back, Adam and I discuss the film Roger Ebert boldly called a perfect movie. Stay with us.
Boys and girls gathered around to wave goodbye to anime. Mama cried and cried. Dad ignored her too. Anime. Find your way. He's 35 and still a child. He sits at home, he's all alone. Anime, find your way to heaven. Anime, find your way
to heaven. Is your flight schedule still the same?
Yes.
Is that bad?
Okay, we'll meet you at the airport. I love you.
I love you too.
Woo! Goodbye!
Unloading of passengers.
Excuse me, Mr. Amra L.
Abraham? Yes?
Sir, we have an emergency message for
you. What is it? Is this my wife?
Is she all right?
Where is he?
I don't know.
What do you want to do? We can't hold him here.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. That was a clip from the trailer for the new film Rendition. And Maddie, as you know, I had the opportunity Monday night while I think you were seeing Rendition. I was seeing Bruce Springsteen in concert here in Chicago.
I still haven't forgiven you.
No, you haven't. And it was a great show. And of course, like you would expect from Springsteen, there is that moment about halfway through the show where he goes off on his anti-Bush rant, talking about all the negative things that have happened to our country and our rights as Americans over the past 6 years. And the first thing he mentioned actually was rendition, this idea of the U.S. taking terror suspects out of the country, outside of their judicial reach, so that they can torture them and try to get information from them. And this movie obviously deals with that. Reese Witherspoon plays the wife of an Egyptian-born man who is supposed to be coming home on a flight and just disappears and, as we see, is detained as one of these terror suspects. And We got an email from a listener here, Maddie, Samuel Todd Stevens at the University of Wisconsin. He writes in and he says, I had the displeasure of seeing an advanced screening of Rendition last night, and right now I'm pretty angry at Roger Ebert. I read his review from Toronto, as did I, where I saw Rendition, in which he lauded Rendition as a perfect film, which, thanks to the TV spots, everyone else has seen by now as well. Rendition is the first movie I've seen this year that was both disappointing enough and bad enough to make me angry. Reese Witherspoon practically bored me to tears and showed me that she's one of the worst fake criers in Hollywood. Mm. Peter Sarsgaard has a permanent, this movie is about an important and weighty topic, and I want you to know it look on his face. Omar Metwally never earned my sympathy as the terror suspect, and Jake Gyllenhaal never really sold me on the moral dilemma he is constantly facing. He's the only major character with any kind of arc, but instead of gradually shifting in one direction, it's more like an instant swing. And I haven't even started on the screenplay, which is one of the most heavy-handed scripts since Crash, and also tries to pull off a twist at the end that basically serves no purpose to the story, while at the same time practically nullifying one-third of the movie you've seen so far. He does have praise for Meryl Streep and Alan Arkin, but says, unfortunately, they're both in the film for about 15 minutes. So, Maddie, I read all of this because I want to ask you, who's right? The esteemed Roger Ebert? Is this a perfect movie or anywhere close? Or Samuel Todd Stevens, our listener in Madison, Wisconsin.
Well, yeah, who's right? Bruce Springsteen or Bill O'Reilly?
Uh-huh.
Well, you know what? I was a little bit surprised by this film because I went in with the lowest of low expectations.
Because I did tell you that I didn't like it.
I heard, well, and also I read some of the reviews online, and it was pretty much how overt and offensive some of this, you know, propaganda is in this film. And yes, it is cartoonish at times in its simplicity, but overall, I have to say, I didn't hate it.
Oh, wow.
I know. I didn't hate
it. The power of lowered expectations.
I know, exactly. Which, so I don't even know what I'm saying. But, I mean, it paints with very broad strokes, and it becomes almost a morality tale or a fable, sort of Mr. Smith goes to Guantanamo, if you will. And, you know, I honestly think I'm only letting it off the hook because it's the first. It's really the first, I think, of its genre. And if you think back, go with me on this. If you think back to movies about Vietnam, the only fictional movie made about Vietnam while we were at the height of the conflict was the John Wayne propaganda piece, The Green Berets. I mean, there were other movies that obviously dealt with the war in sort of a metaphorical way. I think of Straw Dogs by Peckinpah, but it's not until the late 70s and Taxi Driver and Deer Hunter and Apocalypse Now that we really start to hold the war and its fallout under the microscope, and the movies get much, much better. So I think that's what happened here. This movie wants to be topical. They wanted to get together, make a movie about extraordinary rendition, and I think they just simply overreached. I think it's well made. I think I have to disagree with Mr. Stevens. I think it's well acted. But in terms of material and substance, it just rings pretty much hollow. I mean, it just creates too big a tent for itself, and it shoves all these issues inside it. It doesn't really cast a real probing eye on anything.
No, I agree with you on that, though I am with our esteemed listener, Samuel Todd Stevens, on the rest of the film. I think this film is basically Babylana light. It's
You didn't like Babylana.
No, I didn't, but hear me out here. It's Syriana without the smarts, without the depth of that film, and it's Babel minus the technique. I dislike Babel, yes, but Inarritu is an intensely gifted filmmaker, I think, who really knows how to manipulate images and sound. Gavin Hood isn't at that level yet, and yet he tries to pull off some of the same tricks. And as ST mentioned, one at the end in particular that completely fails to add any insight or emotional weight to the movie at all. It just feels like a trick, and one that for me did just pretty much pull the rug out from under me.
Oh, it was completely tacked on.
In terms of what the movie, up until that point, had asked us to invest in a lot of things, and then it just pulls the rug from us. It doesn't work. And then there's Reese Witherspoon and Jake Gyllenhaal. Have you seen the poster, like at a bus stop for this movie? If you see that, that's pretty much the whole film. That's their performances in a nutshell. Reese Witherspoon on the phone looking really concerned, and Gyllenhaal with a vacant, expressionless look on his face. You watch the movie, that is it. That's the extent of what they're given to do. Witherspoon gets her one big emotional scene where she gets to yell at the evil bureaucrats who won't tell her where her husband is, but otherwise she pretty much just gets to make phone calls and beg people to help her
with a really worried look on her face. That's not her fault, and that's my point. That's a movie in and of itself. Imagine if your husband went missing. You need to... My God, you would just be absolutely helpless. I wanted to see that movie. Just whittle it down to that. Introduce the Sarsgaard character. I guess he's an ex-lover. That's not really touched
on. An ex-boyfriend, but
imagine that movie. You know, does this guy actually pony up and help her?
Right.
But the problem is, she's 2 degrees of Kevin Bacon removed from the head of the CIA. No one in America has that much access, can get to a senator that quickly. I really wanted to see a struggle, and you're absolutely right. she just has to make phone calls. And then she, yeah, the terrible where she screams at Meryl Streep.
It's
awful.
A bad scene.
But exactly. But my point is, if that was the movie, instead of coupling it with two other movies and focusing on that one storyline, see, and I think we're going to get that movie a couple of years
maybe
down the road.
We're not disagreeing with each other. I'm saying that's what's wrong with it.
No,
is
I
that
know.
It
I'm
doesn't
agreeing.
Work.
I'm agreeing.
It doesn't work for those reasons.
But
that
I'm
you're
also saying
out.
It was pretty well made. I wasn't bored by this movie.
See, I was bored
really?
By it completely, and I wasn't invested
I thought it was
in
pretty
what was
taut.
Going on. No, no, not at all. And Gyllenhaal, that vacant look on the poster is his vacant look throughout the entire
film.
That's
the same vacant look he's been bringing out for his entire acting career. I mean, this
I
is
know.
The same thing that
yes.
he did in Zodiac, basically
okay.
driven and naive.
Right.
But that's not his fault. And actually, he didn't annoy me here. It's what he's tasked to do. He tries his damnedest.
I agree with you, though. I do think part of it is his performance. But I do blame the screenwriter and Gavin Hood, the director, more than I blame Gyllenhaal. But talking about his performance specifically, I understand that he's supposed to be going through a moral and existential crisis here as this CIA guy who is overseeing this torture of Reese Witherspoon's husband, but you don't see that going on behind those eyes at all. Some actors are brilliant to watch, to just watch them with the gears turning. Mm-hmm. I think Gyllenhaal is not one of those actors. I think he's got the hamster on the wheel up there, and I'm not trying to actually insult Gyllenhaal as a person. I think that every time I've seen him in interviews or on any TV shows, I've always found him to be smart and engaging and quick-witted, but he's just not the right actor to be the guy who's supposed to be the smartest guy in the room or someone plunging into the depths of his psyche like this Martin Sheen in Apocalypse Now type character, and he's asked to do that here, and it just doesn't work. I mean, literally every time the camera cuts to him, he's got that same dopey look on his face, and it does hurt the film.
See, I think, again, we're arguing about how bad this movie is, only in different ways.
Yes.
I actually don't blame him for this. Of course, I'm an actor. I'm probably just coming to the defense of another actor. But I think that, again, he's found himself in another film that should be made and should be given more time. Again, here's a guy that has to deal mm-hmm. with his CIA superior dying on him
right.
within the first 4 minutes of this film. You know? And so, again, I just, it's not his fault that his plot line is unexamined. And for me, I got it. I mean, I could see that this is pretty paint by numbers, but I wasn't offended by it. It's almost like I felt smarter than the movie, as though I could say, okay, yeah, I get it. You know, you're not dumbing me down by doing
right.
it.
Right. Well, as we talked about, there is this twist at the end that we don't really want to get into that doesn't
There's no
work.
Need. It's
and,
just, yeah.
Yeah, and there is a heavy-handedness to it where I don't think the film does deal with the shades of gray in the issue of torture, if there can be shades
oh,
of gray,
no
and I
gray.
Think there
there's
are.
There's no gray in
well,
this movie at all.
Well, I'll say that you're right. There is none in this film at all, because the one character who gets to espouse the other side of it, I guess if you will, the pro-torture side, mm-hmm. is Meryl Streep. And while she's fine in the movie playing a more subtle version of her character from The Devil Wears Prada mm-hmm. as this really powerful character, she's not sympathetic at all. So we don't really buy into her argument at all here.
Yeah.
We're totally on Reese Witherspoon's side. And then we get Gyllenhaal's character just finally getting on a soapbox near the end of this film and making this impassioned anti-torture speech, and I actually want to play that clip from the movie. Here it is.
We have a saying, too. Do you know Shakespeare?
Of course, I know Shakespeare.
I fear you speak upon the rack, where men enforced do speak anything. In all the years you've been doing this, how often can you say that we've produced truly legitimate intelligence? Once? Twice? 10 times? Just give me a statistic. Give me a number. Give me a pie chart. I love pie charts. Anything. Anything that outweighs the fact that if you torture one person, you create 10, 100, 1,000 new enemies.
That's Gyllenhaal at his best.
You think so, Maddie?
That's
well,
brilliant acting.
The quote there that he starts with from Shakespeare about how a man will say anything
on the rack.
On the rack. That is probably the best practical argument against torture anyone will ever come up with. But then we get that really poorly conceived attempt at humor where he's like, give me a pie chart. I love pie charts, which just doesn't work at all. And then it goes into this idea of how many times has torture actually worked? This argument about, has it worked one time, two, 10, he says. And here's my problem with that. And if I'm completely out in left field here, Maddie, you let me know. Listeners, please let me know. But if you're going to turn the torture argument into a utilitarian thing where it's wrong because one person tortured leads to many more who hate you and cause damage, so it's obviously bad, then you have to accept the idea as well that 1, 2, or 10 instances of torture actually leading to legitimate information probably saved hundreds or thousands of lives. I'm not condoning torture. I'm not. But I am saying that I think the film in that moment opens up a really problematic aspect of the argument against rendition that it wants us to see as clearly black and white. And I don't think it follows through. And I think it ends up hurting its own argument in that scene.
You're right. But where I'm giving this movie credit is that it is, I think, going to open the floodgates for better, more subtle, more nuanced movies. If you want a message movie that isn't offensively dumb, I'm not going to go that far as some other people have. I think it's okay. I did not hate this movie.
Okay. I came pretty close to hating it, actually. I was that bored by this film
really?
By the end
See,
of it.
I wasn't bored.
Yeah, I was bored, and then by the end just insulted with the director's twists and some of the polemical goings-on in the script there. Well, Rendition is in theaters now. If you've seen it, share your thoughts by emailing feedback@filmspotting.net.
All right, time for another quick break. When we return, Massacre Theater and listeners broaden our musical horizons with love for Bowie and Babs and other musicians turned actors. Stay with us.
Maddie, let's take a moment to check out what's new on DVD coming out this Tuesday, and I am here to say that this is a glorious day for DVDs because the definitive gold box edition of Twin Peaks is coming out. It's All I Want for Christmas.
I already cut and pasted
one and two,
it onto my Christmas list.
I know. Seasons 1 and 2 of the series, including the pilot episode. This was always the big hang-up with Twin Peaks, is that you could get the series on DVD, but you couldn't get the original pilot, and some people didn't want to start it without seeing the pilot first. Now you can get it all in one set with a bunch of extra features. I cannot wait to check it out. I guess I'm kind of glad I didn't buy season 2, and I just have season 1 at home, so now it wasn't a complete waste of money, just a little bit of a waste of money. Also out, worth checking out, Talk to Me, the movie that Sam and I both really liked. Kiese Lemons, she was a guest here on the show, and Don Cheadle and Chiwetel Ejiofor, both really good in that film about Petey Green. Check that out if you have a chance. And Spider-Man 3, a movie that Sam and I famously liked more than many of our listeners.
That film.
Yes, that was a popular opinion on that film. That is out now in a 2-disc special edition. Two others worth mentioning, No End in Sight, the Iraq documentary that I've heard a lot of great things about. That's finally out. Look forward to checking that out. And Day Watch, this is the follow-up to Night Watch, the Russian blockbuster film. We reviewed that film, Night Watch, and liked it here on Film Spotting. Day Watch really got a very limited theatrical release, but it's out now on DVD. If you're into Russian vampires, you can check out Day Watch.
All right. Now, Adam, we did have some wonderful listeners go over to our site and donate this week. And, of course, for their troubles, they get their patented Sam Van Holgren nickname. Here they are. Robert, Bobby the Dutch, Kendall, abs like Chardonnay. Julie, today's lesson is Jackknife. That's a Silver Club member. Ben, Turbulence is my other middle name. Mark, Salt Lick Blues. And Paul, Deafening Perfection, also another Silver Club member.
Oh, rock and roll.
Right? Thanks. Hey, did you see that movie, Star Wars?
Oh, like 4 times.
People tell me I look like Han Solo.
Really?
Huh. What do you bench?
You tell first.
I asked you first.
Same time.
Cool.
You ready?
Ready.
All right, one.
One,
two, three. You didn't say anything.
No, neither did you.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Film Spotting. It's time now for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I massacre a beloved screenplay, and you, the listener, get a chance at winning a free DVD. Now, last week, we massacred Boogie Nights, an obvious tie-in with Mark Wahlberg's performance in We Own the Night, and our top 5 performances by musicians turned actors. Now, we got Quite a few responses. A lot of love for P.T. Anderson, in fact, in anticipation for his upcoming There Will Be Blood.
Yes, a lot of listeners excited about that film. A lot of listeners excited about P.T. Anderson. You're right. Sure, there are some detractors, but most of our listeners do seem to like him, as we do here on the show. I do have to point out one negative bit of information, though, for our listeners who are really dying to see There Will Be Blood. My understanding is that it's actually been pushed back from an 07 film, late December film, to a January movie. So we're going to have to wait a little bit longer.
A January movie.
Yes, January 08. So we will have to wait a little longer to see Daniel Day-Lewis.
Never a good sign.
In There Will Be Blood.
All right, Adam, we'll reach into the film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Melanie Bruce from Grayslake, Illinois. Congratulations, Melanie. Email feedback at filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Margaret just doesn't miss performances. If she can walk, crawl, or roll, she plays. The show must go on. No, dear. Margot must go on.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. It does tie in with our top five this week. Actors turned directors. We are doing debut performances
right.
by directors, their first films. This is a case where we will admit it is not a first film
right.
from an actor.
But I don't
director.
Think we need to say much
but
more.
We don't need to say anything else, and you started off, so I'm going to give you the action. And action.
Say Will?
Yeah.
That was the first one.
First one what?
First one I ever killed.
Yeah?
You know how I said I shot five men? It weren't true. That Mexican, he come at me with a knife. I just busted his leg with a shovel. I didn't kill him or nothing.
Well, you sure killed the hell out of that fella today.
Hell yeah. I killed the hell out of him, didn't I? Three shots he was taking.
Take a drink, kid.
And scene. Very nice work, sir.
That was terrible by me. Nice work by you. Very depressing effort by me there, Maddie, though.
All right. If you know what film Adam and I just massacred, email your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net by Wednesday, October 31st. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Friday's podcast. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, please surf your way over to filmspotting.net.
Hi, this is Karen calling from San Diego, and I'm hoping that you'll be doing another list of musicians turned actors, so maybe you could feature some females on that list. Maybe it should be called musicians turned actresses, or maybe next time your list can just be more encompassing of both sexes. Some things I thought of, I'm not sure, though, that I'm not positive that these people were singers first, but I believe they were. My votes would go for Bette Midler and The Rose. I would also give it up for Cher in Silkwood and Barbara Streisand in Funny Girl. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Jacob Hall, and I'm from Savannah, Georgia. And listening to your top five performances by musicians today, I was a little upset that you didn't include any performances by David Bowie. In addition to being one of the greatest musical artists of all time, he's lent his persona to so many great performances that's unbelievable. I understand you're not putting Labyrinth in there because it's a bit of a corny performance, but why not The Prestige, where he completely disappeared into a role so unlike him, or a more classy performance in The Man Who Fell to Earth, which is an okay movie.
As always, Maddie, a couple of great voicemails there from our listeners. We have Karen chiding us, wondering where are the women in our musicians turned actress top five, and she's absolutely right. She mentioned Cher and Bette Midler and Barbara Streisand, and I have no excuse. I just have to confess, if I added up all of the Cher, Bette Midler, and Barbara Streisand movies that I've seen, I could count them on one hand.
Well, now, actually, I was going to go with Babs as Fanny Bryce in Funny Girl. Mm-hmm. I was going to put it on there. It probably would have been my number six. I think Cher is really solid. Silkwood and also
Moonstruck?
Moonstruck. Yeah, snap out of it. But Bette Midler, I've really never been warmed over by her.
Not even in The Rose?
Or Beaches. How can you not cry at
it? I know. You're right, because I've never seen it. That's why.
Oh, my God. Are you
I've never
serious?
Seen Beaches. No.
You've never seen
why
Beaches
would I have
on Golden
see...
Pond? I mean, no wonder we are losing female listeners.
We
have
are?
No
You know something about our demographic data that I don't know, Maddie?
I've seen the charts.
Yeah, you've seen the charts, the pie charts. Well, Karen, we do apologize. Obviously, Maddie is more well-rounded in terms of the films from some of those female performers that he has seen. I need to check some of those films out. I will admit to that. And Jacob also wondering, where was David Bowie? No, not for Labyrinth, he said, but The Prestige, where I do think he's very good in The Prestige in a small role.
He's fine.
And as Tesla, yeah. And The Man Who Fell to Earth, he is a very interesting actor, and I certainly understand wanting to give him some recognition on this list.
I absolutely love David Bowie. I certainly love his music. I have most of his albums, and I think he's a presence when he's on screen, mm-hmm. but I wouldn't call him an actor by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, that's probably true of a lot of musicians turned actors.
Yeah.
Great presence on screen, maybe not necessarily great actors. So
it's kind of, you know, kind of the same way I feel about Queen Latifah a little bit. Like a definite presence, but just doesn't have the craft.
Okay.
So
an interesting thought there. Queen Latifah did get some love from some of our listeners, and we will get into some more of your feedback here on that top five list. But first, a couple of quick notes. We did just want to mention, in connection with our interview last week with Wes Anderson and Jason Schwartzman, we got an email from Mikado Murphy, our friend in New York, who works for the New York Times, and he had a chance to do an anatomy of a scene with Wes Anderson, where they pick a scene from the film, and then he talks over the top of it, a little bit of a commentary. It's 2 or 3 minutes long, and you can see that at newyorktimes.com. We'll put a link in the notes for this show. So thank you, Mikado, for passing that along. And also wanted to mention, Maddie, that Estee Stevens, who was featured prominently in our discussion in the last segment of Rendition, he also wrote in to say that he's very sorry to disappoint Carrie Shepherd, our contributor last time, who talked about the diving bell and the butterfly. She mentioned at the end of her commentary that she was really hoping it's going to be the best foreign language film winner at this year's Oscars, and ST points out that Diving Bell and the Butterfly won't be nominated for the Best Foreign Film Award this year due to the screwy process the Academy instituted a few years ago, where each country submits only one film. This year, apparently, France chose to submit Persepolis instead of The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. I did not see Persepolis at Toronto, so I can't compare the two films, but obviously, as I said last week, I love Diving Bell and the Butterfly, and I think that is too bad that it won't get that recognition, but hopefully some of our listeners will get a chance to check it out here at some point. Another quick note on our November 9th show, where we will be talking about the new Coen Brothers film, No Country for Old Men, which I've seen twice now. We will have an interview with Josh Brolin, who is fantastic in that film, No Country for Old Men. I've actually already recorded the interview, and we may get a chance, Maddie, maybe coming into the next segment, we may have to play the drop he recorded for us promoting Film Spotting. I think some of our listeners will get a kick out of it, so we will have that coming up. Let's move on to our poll questions here real quick, Maddie. Last week, we asked listeners, tying in with American Gangster, which we're going to review on next week's show. This is the new Ridley Scott film. We asked you, Ridley Scott's best film, excluding Alien and Blade Runner, which are pretty much unanimously regarded as classics, his best film is, and the choices were, Black Hawk Down, Gladiator, Kingdom of Heaven, Matchstick Men, Thelma and Louise, or other Come On White Squall. How did it come out, Maddie?
Well, pretty overwhelming. Gladiator comes in number one at 42%. Black Hawk Down in at 21%. And then a tie, a little bit of surprise for me. Matchstick Men and Thelma and Louise both garnering 14%. Kingdom of Heaven only 5%. Tying with other. You know, I like that film. Actually, I think it's one that kind of goes overlooked. But, you know, another one that probably got a lot of love was The Duelists with Harvey Keitel from 77.
That's true. A lot of people did point that film out in comments to the poll or in emails to us, but I have to give credit to our listeners because the poll came out, the results came out exactly how I would have ranked the films. Oh, wow. Actually, Gladiator, then Black Hawk Down, then Matchstick Men, though I do like Thelma and Louise, then Thelma, and then Kingdom of Heaven would have been last in that group for me. So
I'm right with our listeners.
Oh, yeah, I'm feeling great about
Look
that.
At the smug little smile you got on your face now.
Okay, well, let's move on. Speaking of smug, to Ben Affleck. Let's find out how our listeners feel about Ben Affleck. We want to know, tying in, obviously, with Gone Baby Gone this week, what you think Ben Affleck's best performance or best role is. And the choices are, Maddie.
What a mighty canon this is.
Yes.
George Reeves in Hollywoodland, Holden in Chasing Amy, O'Banion in Dazed and Confused, Chucky in Good Will Hunting, or other.
Maybe you're thinking of the Alec Baldwin ripoff scene in Boiler Room.
Or Daredevil.
His cameo there, or his performance in Daredevil, of course, a classic performance. Let us know what you think about Ben Affleck.
Where would you fall on that list?
Where would I fall? I would probably have to go with Holden in Chasing Amy, just because I do like the film, and I do think he is very good in that role. I think that's probably his best, most memorable performance.
No, it's O'Banion in Dazed and Confused. Yeah. He's fantastic in that.
Speaking of memorable, you're right. Well, let's get on to the mailbag then, Maddie. Some of the responses we received to last week's top five about musicians turned actors. And last week, I think it was, we had a listener correcting me about the fact that I got the director of Risky Business wrong. This week, some listeners took issue with one of your choices. This is Damon Bishop in Chicago, Illinois. He says, I enjoyed show number 182. I have a problem with your inclusion, Maddie, of Will Oldham, though, in the top five performances by musicians turned actors list.
Yes.
The point was made of J-Lo's inability to make the list due to her acting before any albums came out, yet Will Oldham started acting a good 4 or 5 years before releasing any records. The earliest record I can find is 1990's Fearful Symmetry. He started acting with 1986 is what comes around. In 1987, he had a fairly large role in John Sayles' Mate Juan, which I have to confess, I love that film and completely forgot that he was in it, and was featured on the soundtrack album. Old Joy is certainly the most screen time he has had, but he is no newcomer to acting. I'm not suggesting you redo the list. Maybe just add Lyle Lovett's performance in Shortcuts instead. What's good enough for J-Lo is good enough for Bonnie Prince Billy. That's Damon here in Chicago.
Yeah, fine. Mea culpa. I just have to admit, he sort of hits it on the head here. He went out to L.A. as a kid. He was an actor and a musician at that time, and then he turned his back on Hollywood. I mean, people couldn't convince him to do movies, and so he really launched his sort of cult musical career and came back with this film. I just wanted to draw attention to the film.
Yes.
I knew this history.
Absolutely. We do give you a pass on this one, or at least I give you a pass.
Thank you.
We move on to this great email here from Hennessy, who says, Maddie, he loves the show, but he often doesn't like the music we play on the show. And I think when you get into his choices here, you'll maybe see why we have different tastes in music.
Yeah. So when you came up with your latest top five list of best performances by musicians turned actors, I knew that some of my favorite performers would not make your list. Please keep in mind that this is not my top five because my list would probably include Kris Kristofferson and Lone Star with an honorable mention nod to Dwight Yoakam in Panic Room. Yeah, very good, Adam. Both on your list.
Both on my list.
All
Thank
right,
you.
Number five, it's a tie. Eminem, 8 Mile in Tip, T.I. Harris in ATL. Number four, Ice-T in New Jack City. Number three, Ice Cube, Boys in the Hood. His performance is probably why John Singleton has a career as a director. Number two, Will Smith Ali on my list. I don't think that there's any artist on your list that can match the combined musical and acting success of Will Smith and Ali is his crowning achievement. Very well put. And number one, Jamie Foxx as Ray.
Yes, and he says that before you say he was an actor first, keep in mind that he was a Juilliard-trained classical pianist before he went into stand-up comedy. I love Jamie Foxx's performance in Ray. I do think that's a much bigger violation, though, of our rules than even Will Oldham is.
Yeah.
The fact is, nobody knew Jamie Foxx as a musician before he broke onto the scene as a comedian and then ultimately an actor. So I would probably have to leave him off on a technicality, but again, I completely understand why Hennessy would want to shed some light
there. Ice Cube was definitely
there.
Number seven or so on my list. I love him as Doughboy.
Yeah, and I strongly considered Ice Cube as well. Ice-T in New Jack City, I do like him there. We also considered Eminem and 8 Mile. So they were all close but just didn't make the final cut there. Which brings us to this one from Sean Lane here in Chicago, who also had to chime in on the Will Oldham correction. But he mentioned that we talked about Lyle Lovett in The Player, but he preferred him in Shortcuts as the baker who makes a major faux pas with a client. He says, Most Def is getting a lot of attention for his acting lately, and I could take him or leave him for the most part, but he was great in an HBO film called Something the Lord Made. Check that one out on DVD if you haven't seen it. Joan Jett was the only bearable part of watching Light of Day. Come on, Michael J. Fox in that movie as a musician? Finally, the first thought I had when thinking about this list was Richard Edson, the original drummer for Sonic Youth. He has become the quintessential that guy over the last 20 years. For one performance, I'd have to take him as the dumber brother, Pino, in Do the Right Thing. Keep up the good work, Sean says. I love this list. I have to admit, this is my lack of music credibility coming through here. I had no idea that Richard Edson was the original drummer for Sonic Youth. But this is the guy from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, of course, the parking attendant who takes the car out for that long drive.
He's got a commercial out right now, I
think. He does, you're right. He is really great in a lot of that guy roles. I love that Sean thought of Richard Edson. And again, I really had no idea that he was a drummer.
I know. All right, here we got another one from Brad in Chicago. He says, Hey, Adam and Maddie, when I heard what your top five was going to be, immediately one performance popped into my head. I don't know if you guys ever got a chance to check out this movie, or if you did, you even cared for it, but I've got to give props to Tim McGraw in Friday Night Lights. It's easily my favorite sports film, and hell, one of my favorite films in general, and his performance completely took me by surprise. In the first 10 minutes, we see his character, an albeit slightly cliched abusive alcoholic father, present himself, and he never misses a step. His performance is believable, natural, and impassioned, and I have to say, I actually am familiar with the TV show. I love the TV show. I've never seen the film.
You haven't seen the film. I have seen the film, and I did like the film, and I really did like Tim McGraw's performance in the movie. I think Brad did a nice job there describing the performance and bringing some attention to it. He deserves the recognition. Though, for me, that movie was one of those cases where, and this is totally unfair, but I love the book so much, and the movie just can't match the depth of the book in terms of what it covers, and so the movie felt incomplete. And this is exactly why, for me, I try to hold off and not read the books of movies that I'm about to see. I usually do want to wait until later. With No Country for Old Men, I'm reading that right now after having seen the movie. So again, I think it's totally unfair, but it just didn't quite live up to what I remembered from the book.
All right, time for one last quick break. When we come back, Adam and I recognize our top five actors who got lucky their first time behind the camera. Please stay with us.
I'm gonna find a way to make you love me all the time. I'm gonna find a way to make you love me. I call your name. I make you in my dreams. Can't you?
Film Spotting's Top 5 is presented by Spout.com. Share your lists, reviews, and discuss movies with your friends for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
This is Josh Brolin from The Goonies 2. You're listening to Film Spotting? That's a question.
I mean, it just suddenly, it just changed direction and went whizzing right off, man. It flashed.
You're stoned out of your mind, man.
Oh, yeah, man. Hey, like, I'm stoned, you know, man? But, like, you know, I saw a satellite. And it was going across the sky, and it flashed three times at me and zigzagged and whizzed off, man.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. A clip there from Easy Rider, Dennis Hopper in the scene, and Dennis Hopper behind the camera there, of course, his directorial debut, an actor-turned-director, Dennis Hopper with Easy Rider, a film that will not make my list or your list, but I'm calling my list, Maddie, the Easy Rider Memorial List.
Yeah, it probably would have been right up there, number one or two.
Yeah, it would have been right up there for both of us, so we are calling it the Easy Rider Memorial List. These are actors turned directors in their first movies. We did decide to limit this a little bit, tie in really closely with Gone Baby Gone.
Made it harder.
Make it harder.
Because a lot of these guys really don't hit their stride about two or three films into
that's
their
true,
canon.
But it does open it up to such a wide range of films to choose from that only picking five is also equally difficult. So we did want to limit it down a little bit. Maddie, what is your number five?
Well, my number five, I can just imagine the people at home getting ready to send hate mail about this pick, but I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway, and that's Kevin Costner with Dances with Wolves. No matter how much damage Costner did to the rest of 1990s cinema by almost single-handedly destroying the modern-day epic, I think, this is still an ambitious and terrific film, and we forget how relevant Costner was back then. He was coming off of Bull Durham and The Untouchables, and I think the Buffalo Hunt scene in Dances with Wolves is such a cinematic achievement that that's why it's on my list.
Okay, I don't think you're going to get much argument from
really?
Listeners, or at least I think they will recognize
it kinda
your
beat,
case.
It kind of beat out another film for Best Picture that year.
Yes,
it
just
slips
maybe
my mind.
A Scorsese
slips
film.
My mind. Yeah,
I'm sure it doesn't slip Martin Scorsese's mind. My number five, Maddie, is Tim Robbins with his directorial debut, Bob Roberts,
yeah, good
the
one.
1992.
I almost want that one.
Yeah, it's a mock documentary political satire where he really does do a great job using this huge ensemble cast. I mean, Gore Vidal is great in the film, but he gets Susan Sarandon, of course, and Peter Gallagher, and all these people.
Introduces
Jack Black in his first role. Giancarlo Esposito is also in the film, but a lot of great actors. Ray Wise, of course, from Twin Peaks fame. All those people get used in different ways throughout the film, and it really does turn out to be this really funny political satire. I mean, the songs in the film, he's playing this Bob Dylan-inspired arch-conservative using the 60s hippies music kind of against them here in the 90s. But it's a film that I loved the first time I saw it, and still, like, I'm a big fan of Tim Robbins' films in general, as everyone knows, to your disdain. I like Cradle Will Rock, and I like Dead Man Walking, and this was his first. I think it's good.
Well, the 60s are, let's face it, a dark stain on American history. At no other time has lawlessness and immorality been so widespread.
You're speaking of Watergate and our invasion of Cambodia.
No, No, I'm not. I see. I'm speaking of you. I'm speaking of lawlessness and immorality with regard to drug use and sexual practice.
Excuse me?
Disregard in the press for the sacred institutions that have made this country what it is today.
Is social protest disregard for our laws and institutions?
Certainly it is.
Yeah, I love Dead Men Walking. I think Bob Roberts is probably his second best film.
Okay.
All right, well, my number four, I'm going to give a little love to Paul Mazursky because we kind of took some credit away from him for Risky Business. So I'm going to throw him some love for Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, of course, 1969. Mazursky, like others, got his start as an actor on some of those great sponsored movie hours on television with names like the Kaiser Aluminum Hour and the United States Steel Hour and the Chevy Mystery Show. And he's been a working actor ever since. In fact, I just saw him recently in Someone to Eat Cheese With, and also been a very successful director, but Bob and Carol was his first, and it's a great exploration of sexual mores. I mean, Bob and Carol, played by Bob Saunders and Natalie Wood, decide they're going to open up their love life. Ted and Alice, these conservatives, are shocked. They all go to Vegas, and of course, they attempt a foursome. It's wonderful, and it still holds up. Diane Cannon used to be a force, and she has this great scene with a therapist, and the ending is actually terrifically surreal, and it breaks the fourth wall, and I think it represents some of the most avant-garde work that he's done.
Well, it is a film I have to admit I have not seen and have always
wanted
to see.
It's a great film.
And I will definitely check it out. Now, my number four, speaking of forces, Vincent Gallo with his debut as a director, Buffalo 66. This is a movie that I think really tries to be pretty out there in terms of experimenting with things. The great Yes sequence, Heart of the Sunrise, we get at the end with the tableau shots and the use of that song there. But even the scene with his family that we get, where he's this guy who's just been let out of prison, kidnaps Christina Ricci to come home and tries to act like he's got this great thing going. And his mom and dad, played by Ben Gazzara and Angelica Houston, are so fantastic. But it's like Ozu on crack in terms of the way the camera is set up and the way it cuts from angle to angle of this really dysfunctional family. And I just think, again, that the way Gallo, as an actor, I think he's really good in it, but as a director, in terms of using the jump cuts and using the tableau stuff at the end, he really is trying a lot of different things. Not all of it maybe works, but I love the intensity of Buffalo 66.
Yeah, it's a good pick. It certainly would be in my top 10. Now, my number three, 2001, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, John Cameron Mitchell. This film is so innovative, and its images are so evocative. I really was stunned when I learned that Mitchell had never directed before. And, you know, because it's, I think he actually talks about it on the DVD. They couldn't find a director for the project or no one that he wanted. He said, well, I'll just do it. How hard can it be? And now he's come out with Short Bus, and here's a guy who's really pushing the envelope. I love where he's taking cinema right now, and it's just from, it just goes to show you, actors can do anything.
Can't believe I overlooked him. I completely forgot that Hedwig was his first film. It is a movie I like a lot as well. Great pick. My number three, I'm going with Todd Field for In the Bedroom, and it ties in nicely with Gone Baby Gone, New England, and parents and grief and the loss of children. But this is a movie, it's come up before, I know, with a couple top fives, and of course Todd Field was on the show. I had an interview with him tying in with Little Children, but I just think that movie is basically perfect in terms of the way it's constructed, the way every scene has a huge emotional arc to it. Sissy Spacek, Tom Wilkinson. Unfortunately, I don't think Tom Wilkinson has been as good in anything since that, but I love all those performances in The Bedroom. Talk about, again, a haunting, really kind of disturbing, devastating film. I think it's great.
I love that film. I think we talk about authenticity. His examination of that family is so dead on and brilliant. And actually, I'm not as enamored with his follow-up, Little Children. I actually think he did it so much better in that beautiful first film.
Well, I like Little Children, but I would agree with you. I think In the Bedroom is probably the better achievement. I would agree.
All right. Well, my number two is Charles Laughton, Night of the Hunter. I actually sung this film's praises a couple weeks ago when highlighting one of its stars, Lillian Gish. A terrifying film. Robert Mitchum, of course, with the love and the hate knuckles. He menaces a West Virginia family in an attempt to find some buried stolen cash. Lawton's expressionistic filmmaking really has made this iconic picture really what it is and why it still holds up.
Yeah, and Robert Mitchum's performance, as you said. Oh. I mean, he is such a brilliant actor. My number two pick is, here listeners can all roll their eyes because they know it's come up a lot, especially when Sam was here on the show. It came up a lot in top fives, but it is Kenneth Branagh for Henry V. I have to go with that. This is a film that he was nominated for Best Actor that year in 1989 and also Best Director.
And he was like 14 years old,
exactly.
Right?
He was pretty young at the time, but I think what he does with this film, and as I've said before, it's my favorite Shakespearean play, so I'm kind of partial to Henry V, but I think he does an amazing job of taking Shakespeare and making it accessible. You can take someone who doesn't know the story of Prince Hal and Henry IV and just dive them into Branagh's Henry V, and I think follow it pretty damn well. And I think he makes it accessible, as I said, without dumbing it down at all. And I actually think he also makes Henry a really interesting, complex character in ways that Olivier maybe didn't before him when he was glorifying Henry V on stage during the war.
You are treading on some creaky ice there, my friend.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I'm not trying to criticize Olivier as an actor, but in terms of how he portrayed Henry V, there really wasn't any dark side to Henry. It was pretty a glorification.
And you're absolutely right. If for any reason you're not seeing this film because it's a Shakespearean film and you're just maybe just a little bit scared of it, go check it out. It is a fantastic achievement. All right, well, I'm going to follow it up with this. This is my number one. Hello, my name is Marty DeBurgi. I'm a filmmaker. I make a lot of commercials. That little dog that chases the covered wagon underneath the sink, that was mine. Yep, I'm giving it to Marty DeBurgi for This is Spinal Tap, one of my favorite films of all time. The way DeBurgi captures the zeitgeist of the 80s, and he shines such a critical, scathing light on the world of heavy metal. He obviously borrows from the masters like Penny Baker and Morris. He just turns the camera on, lets them roll, lets his subjects either hang or redeem themselves. I mean, these guys in this band are just so out there. Each frame is hilarious. Now, I know DeBurgi's done a couple follow-up projects with Billy Crystal, some small things, but I'm still waiting. I'm waiting for the big follow-up.
You're waiting for the next Marty DeBurgi production. Well played, Maddie, by you. And I have to say, again, I completely forgot about this film. It would have been my number one. I think it very well could have been my number one. I feel terrible now. But I still think my number one is okay, if not somewhat obvious, and it's Robert Redford for Ordinary People. You mentioned Kevin Costner. Sure, he beat out Goodfellas, and what a travesty that is. Well, I still look back on 1980 as a little bit of a travesty for the fact that he beat out Scorsese for Raging Bull that year. But Ordinary People, I think, is a really great film. Mary Tyler Moore, Donald Sutherland, Timothy Hutton are all so good in the movie. Of course, Judd Hirsch as the therapist as well. And it does tie in nicely with Gone Baby Gone in that I think that Good Will Hunting, as I've said before, steals so much from those therapy scenes between Timothy Hutton and Judd Hirsch in terms of what kind of gets Timothy Hutton back on the right track is exactly what we see happen, the breakthrough we see happen with Matt Damon's character in Good Will Hunting. But it's a film I absolutely love. Again, another Chicago movie, too, set in Lake Forest in those kind of icy suburbs where everything's supposed to be perfect, but what's hiding underneath the surface is really terrible, and we see that really nicely portrayed in this film. Robert Redford's debut as a director. It was Ordinary People, my number one.
Okay, well, great pick. I think we're going to get a lot of good feedback here because I think there are a lot that we had to leave off. I'm thinking, you know, Mario Van Peebles and New Jack City and some others.
Yeah, I would think of Sarah Pauli had a great debut this year, Away From Her. And also I think a lot of credit should be given to Billy Bob Thornton for Sling Blade.
Ooh,
that was one that was
that's a good
one.
That's a really
good
one.
Came very close to making my top five.
All right, well, those are our top five debut films by actors turned directors. Remember, they are debut films. Send your list or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voice message.
Opening wide this weekend, Dan and the Real Girl with Steve Carell and Juliette Binoche and Saw 4. Maddie, I know you can't wait to see it.
Woo-hoo.
Expanding to more screens, The Darjeeling Limited and Lars and the Real Girl.
I want to check that one out.
I do want to check it out as well. On next week's show, we'll review the new Ridley Scott film with Denzel Washington and Russell Crowe, American Gangster, and we will discuss the second film in our Ingmar Bergman marathon, 1957's The Seventh Seal. Last week, Maddie, you told our listeners, you warned them, get it in your Netflix queue, and we didn't follow our own advice.
I know.
We did not get it in our Netflix queues, so we did not check it out, but we will discuss it next week. The Bergman Marathon will be back.
All right. Thank you so much to the gorgeous Alex and Angela on our message boards, the fantastic Frank Huckle, and the overwhelmingly awesome Candace Griffiths. Thanks also to Utah Carol for this week's music. Learn more at utahcarol.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Maddie Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout. Visit filmspotting.spout.com to discuss this episode.
back to Film Spotting with Adam and Muddy Volume. Yeah. Oh, drive time 9:52. Let's go to Weathers on the Tens with Dan and Chopper 8.
You want to be a morning DJ, don't you?
I love it. Actually, I'd love to be a play-by-play guy. We got a runner on, two out here. Ball and a strike to Liriano. He's going to step out here.
He's kind of out day it's been.
When Springsteen talked, did he kind of talk down like this?
He did.
I just want to say a lot of things. My daddy, when I was 6 years old, he'd say a lot of things about how things were and how they were supposed to be. And, you know,